the Edison Institute for the Center for the Study of the History of Design. And today, this is April 15th, 1985, and we are in beautiful Green Valley, Green Valley, Arizona, talking with Mr. George Eugene Bud Adams, who is a long-time stylist and engineering and design craftsman at Ford Motor Company. And Mr. Adams has recorded three earlier tapes for us, and today we are hoping to fill in the in between the gaps or expand or more details on his long and interesting career at Ford Motor Company. So, Bud, if you could take it from the beginning.
Dave, my father was a toolmaker at the Rouge plant of Ford, and he passed away when I was 12. And at the time, I was happily attending public school in Detroit with no particular idea of what I wanted to be or what career I wanted to pursue. I was taking what would amount to a college preparatory course in intermediate school. I remember I had a Latin class and a real tough teacher, Mrs. Savage. And after Dad died, my mother found it pretty tough going because those were Depression years. And she was able to contact my father's old superintendent, Mr. Gardam, and he got me an application to enter the trade school.
Was it Garland?
No, Gardam, I think is G-A-R-D-H-A-M, as far as I remember, Dave. And so I left the ninth grade there and became a trade school student with the blue skull cap, the shop apron, the black bow tie, and the badge on the left shoulder.
Did you have any, what were the entrance requirements
for trade school? Well, I think the entrance requirements were to be either an orphan or having a father who had passed away and knowing someone at Ford Motor Company. Well, it was this superintendent that my mother had contacted, and he was my dad's old toolroom superintendent. And he got me the application to go out and get in the school. And at that time, the trade school was on the upper floors of the B building at the Rouge plant.
What year was this?
1932. And for a youngster to walk into that environment, getting off the Michigan streetcar and going up Gate 4 Road past the engine building and watching those cupola cars full of either hot cast iron or slag go by, and in the winter months it was dark when you were going to school, it was kind of frightening, actually. And I wasn't used to mercury vapor lights, which the shop used, and I wasn't used to the noise and smell of cutting oils and things of that kind. But after, oh, and you learn to punch a time clock real quickly. We were, the student body was split into three sections, and so you were in the trade school shop activity 2 weeks, and then in their schoolrooms 1 week, and you alternated that way. And when you graduated, you really didn't get a high school diploma because you the trade school placed a heavy emphasis on mathematical subjects and drafting subjects, subjects that would be useful in a trade such as tool making or tool design or pattern making. And they were a little short on English and history, so some of the boys decided to go to public night school and pick up credits in history and English and get a high school diploma. Now, I myself never did this. What I did was take every damned apprentice school course that was available. And the apprentice school was an additional night school that was run in the same building where you would attend a class once or twice a week. You got to do your homework at home and bring in the answers on an answer sheet and turn them in for review and correction. And this carried you through such subjects as slide rule and trigonometry and solid trigonometry. And these were all courses arranged around skills that a qualified toolmaker would have to use. And they reflected problems that had been encountered in the shop, whether making dies for the body panels or fixtures and tools for machining parts of the engine or whatever. They all reflected problems that had arisen there and had been sent up to the trade school for solution and assistance to the shop, and the trade school incorporated these into their educational material. And their practical shop mathematics books were actually published by McGraw-Hill and became sort of a Bible for that type of training that a toolmaker should have in mathematics. But anyhow, the trade school feature, which my mother was mainly interested in, was that the trade school paid a cash scholarship. Now, I suspect that the term scholarship was used to avoid any implications involving child labor, but every week you'd get your pay envelope with cash inside at the rate of, starting rate anyway, for me, of 15 cents an hour. And that was what kept Mother and me alive during those tough Depression years. My mother worked as a sales lady off and on, but as I say, times were tough. And her income was largely dependent on commissions. And I could always tell when she would come home from work and by the expression on her face whether she had a good day and she'd sold more than $100 worth or whatever. And but the underlying security was the trade school cash scholarship that I'd bring home and give to her. And the trade school reflected in its operation Mr. Henry Ford's beliefs, one of which was in thrift, and they encouraged that by, I think, every month giving you a couple dollars to deposit in a bank account. And true to the Ford bean counter tradition, well, you had to bring your bank book in and have it checked off by the school office to make sure you were putting it in and not taking it out. And the other thing was that there was an incentive to do good work because on your report card, as I recall, at the bottom of the card there were three basic grades. I think two of them had to do with shop and one had to do with school. And if you could get three A's on there, you could get a nickel an hour raise, which was quite substantial. And for two A's and a B, why, it might have been 3 cents or whatever. So there was an incentive to do well in school. And at that time, the trade school had the they didn't have any females, which I didn't really think was much of a handicap, but they did have a full range of athletic activities. We had softball teams, and there was an annual picnic at Boblo where you could play golf or baseball or whatever, and your girlfriend, you could dance at the pavilion afterwards, and it was just the whole day at Boblo, which was quite an experience. Well, during the trade school time, I continued to sketch and do lettering, which I like to do. And actually, as a very young kid in the public schools, my folks, or I guess it was my art teacher in school, got me into a class on Saturdays down at the Children's Museum in Detroit. And so I remember making a little gorilla out of clay down there, which eventually fell apart. But I had an interest in art subjects that early, I remember. And so in the trade school, why I did a lot of lettering. In fact, I made the first diploma that the school offered. And this was one of these old English script affairs, pretty crummy by professional standards of today, but at least it was legible. And I did a couple of program illustrations for the annual Boblo picnic, and a few other jobs of that kind while I was at the trade school. And I graduated in 1935, and the system then was, if you were not old enough, if you were not 18, you were not old enough for a Ford badge. So they would keep you on as a so-called senior. And this meant that you would spend full time in the shop as a specialist on a certain type of machine, such as a precision boring mill. Or, like I did, I spent my time in the tool design room doing drafting work and some of these special lettering assignments. So in 1937, the design department, which was set up by Edsel Ford under Bob Gregory, evidently needed a little more cheap help or something to work on the full-size clay models. So they appealed to the trade school to send someone over. And because of the lettering and other work that I'd done at the trade school, I was picked as one of the guys. And Emmett O'Rear was the other, that two of us were first shipped over to the design department. And we arrived there a week or two after Johnny Nager, who had been sent over from the Ford Training School, which was a different school for high school graduates at Gate 4 Road on Miller Road. And so we were, at least I was, sort of awed trying to find the place on my first day. I got to the engineering lab and found the design department in the corner of the building, enclosed by golden oak and frosted glass partitions. And I tried a couple of the doors, which were locked at that time. I got there a half an hour early, I think. And this character with a mustache and short, high-cut trouser cuffs walked by and asked me what the heck I was doing, and I told him I wanted to get in the place. I was supposed to report there. It turned out that this mustachioed, balding guy with the beady eyes was Bob Gregory. And that was my introduction to the design department, was wondering why I wasn't inside when all the doors were locked. But Emmett and I initially were sort of apprenticed to the head clay modeler, who was this old Dick Benike. And Dick was a short, a dumpy, lovable type guy. At least I enjoyed him very much. Dick had learned his trade as an industrial sculptor in the old country, in Germany. And he used to tell us how the apprenticeship system worked over there. And when you got to the point where you earned your journeyman's ticket, you had to leave your hometown and earn your way in other areas of Germany, other towns. If you came back to your hometown, it was an admission that you had failed and you couldn't cut the mustard, and it was a matter of disgrace. And Dick would assign us to help slap the clay on these full-size forms, which were made out of wood and had sort of a lath, a wood lath skin to which the clay could adhere, because it would ooze in between the laths. And we got the clay from the Ford made clay ovens, and these were wood and aluminum structures heated by light bulbs, and they had aluminum trays in there with the pieces of clay and the shavings from clay models, which would be heated by these bulbs so that it would be workable. The clay we used then was gray in color, and it had sort of a wax base because it would be kneadable and workable when it was warm, and it would, when it cooled off, it would set up and it could be finished smoothly and actually painted. So the one incident that I mentioned before, in which I've given you a write-up on, Dave, was after a couple of weeks or a few days doing this sort of thing, we were watching Dick apply clay to a fender, as I remember, and then shave it off with his different modeling tools and scrapers. And I asked Dick, Dick, how do you know when you've got a good line or you've got a good form? I was trying to get at what the real principle was or what guided you when you were working on these full-size models. And Dick had a real long upper lip, and he sort of rolled his tongue behind that upper lip a while and thought for a minute or two, and he says, well, it's really pretty simple. What you do is put on what isn't enough, and you take off what's too much. And that's the type of guidance that we were able to get out of Beinecke early on. But it soon, after working there and working on these models for a while, you developed a sense of form continuity and began to realize what the game was all about. And, of course,
what sort of guidance did Gregory give you?
Well, I made a number of tent-size clay models from sketches that Gregory would produce. And these were for, you might say, theme exploration or preliminary studies. And so we knew what the intended wheelbase was supposed to be. We'd take Gregory's sketch and on a little tent size modeling table with a tent size bridge, mahogany bridge, we would get the wood shop to make up a form and build up the clay on that to reflect what Gregory had sketched, either as a front end theme or a rear end theme or both in a complete model. And I'd have to say this, that I always felt that Gregory could make sketches that just couldn't be done in three dimensions. He had a rare talent in that respect. So there was a little bit of diplomacy that had to be utilized when you'd work up this drawing, and you'd have the right dimensions for the headlights and the right dimensions for the wheels and tires, and you'd have the headlights positioned at the proper height per legal requirements, and it still didn't quite look like Gregory's sketch. You had to indicate to him what was going on and that you'd done your very best. But he was, I would have to say, easy to work for. But we younger guys always considered him to be the world's greatest tightwad as far as wages were concerned.
Really?
Now, when Emmett and I came over, we were trade school seniors, still had a trade school senior badge. And in 1937, I was, just about 19, I guess. Anyway, my recent experience would indicate, I'd have to say Gregory wasn't the master of his own ship as far as giving wages was concerned. The whole department was, as I understood, funded by Edsel Ford's private account or whatever, and there was and it was Edsel's baby, and he had created the department in the first place. And
before then, you'd been sent to outside firm.
Yes, Briggs used to do the body design and body engineering for Ford. And I think the first body that Ford completely engineered themselves was a 1937 model. And I can still recall that in the body draft for that model, they showed a milk can standing up in the trunk, which was a requirement of Henry No. 1, that the farmer should be able to take his milk cans down to the station if he had to. And anyway, when we first came over, I don't think there could have been more than 25 people in total in the design department, and that included some designers that actually worked on the board. Now, there was Walter Krook, and he was a graduate of the Yale School of Fine Arts. And Walter told me one time that he, when he was at Yale, had his own orchestra, and he was actually in competition with Rudy Valli. And Walt's band evidently didn't succeed, and he had committed himself for the cost of uniforms and whatever, and so he came and went to work on the Ford Lake Freighters and earned enough money to pay off his debts for this band experience. And with his fine art training, he somehow ended up in this design department. Then there was Johnny Walter, and John was a short fellow with thick glasses and a sort of a rounding head that became a, when he left Ford, he went into business for himself as an industrial designer. And I remember he used to do a lot of work for Whirlpool on appliances, ovens and washers and dryers and things of that kind. John was one of the guys that said that, oh, gee, if you're going to be anything as a designer, you got to get out and circulate. You don't want to work for one company all your life. You know, you ought to go to Hudson's or Packard or someplace and float around a bit. Well, there was also a couple of pattern makers, woodworkers. Jimmy Mearns was one of them. I can't recall the other fellow's name. But they helped build the Bucks, and they would help Jimmy Lynch, who ran the shop. And then there were, let's see, there was, I think we had a permanent sort of sweeper janitor around there, because there was still a little concern about security of design. You didn't want everybody marching in and out. But anyway, if there was a total of 25 people at that time, why, that was about it. And evidently, the work that Emmett and I did couldn't have been too bad, because they kept sending over afterwards, sending over additional trade school students to help out. And I remember Frank Barbera, Benny Barbera was one of them, Frank Byers was one of them, and several others. There's a copy of a trade school paper that I saved, which showed the group of trade school graduates there. And the work that we did was varied, in that we didn't do clay modeling 100% of the time. We had a chance to do some drafting and some design suggestions for instrument panels and other components. And we would be able to start an instrument panel design, for example, by picking up the A-pillar width limitations and the proposed windshield line from body engineering, drawing up our own buck, and then having the wood shop make the buck out of wood for us. And we'd create our own plastic templates from the design that we had laid out, and proceed to model up the whole panel suggestion, and draw up suggestions for the instruments themselves, and have them made in the shop out of aluminum and plexiglass and so on. So it was a varied experience. It was very, very worthwhile. Now, one of the things that I recall, which is hilarious by today's standards in the design activity, had to do with the 41 Ford. The 41 Ford and Mercury were to share a common body, and the and the Mercury had its own unique front end, 4 inches longer and wheelbase from the dash forward. And these bodies had body full-size models had been pretty well completed and put together, and they were set up so that work could begin on modeling the front ends. Well, I was assigned to the Ford model. And contrary to what usually went on, I was getting no direction whatsoever. I didn't have any sketch from Gregory. I didn't have any sketch from one of the designers, Walt Crook or Bill our friend from California. Anyway, Bill Wagner, or Johnny Walter, or anybody else. And so what I did, all of us knew the legal heights for headlights, and we knew where the bumper should be and what an acceptable overhang in the front would be, and we knew where to find the corners of the radiator. And so I went to work like a little crazy beaver, and I just modeled this damn front end design right on the model, full-size model, and I thought things were looking pretty good. And one morning, Gregory came by and sort of did a double take and turned around and said something like, gee, that's not too bad. And I was kind of elated because this was fresh out of old Adam's head, you know. And I was even more astounded when I found a couple days later it had actually been approved. So I was proceeding to put the final touches on this front end and getting ready to apply aluminum foil for the plated parts of the grill and so forth when I detected a movement of people behind me, and I turned around and here's the whole top echelon of the company marching in to take a look at this 41 Ford front end. Well, there was Charlie Sorensen, and he was a tall, blonde, handsome guy, tanned, very erect posture. And there was P.E. Martin, who was universally detested. There was Crawford with his shock of white hair.
John Crawford?
Yeah.
Personal assistant?
Either that or he was company secretary. I can't remember what. And Sheldrick, who was chief engineer at the time.
Larry Sheldrick.
And Weibel, who was the boss of purchasing, as I remember. And this whole troop of executives came in, and they wanted to see what they were going to have to build, of course. And so I very quietly got up off my stool and backed up out of the way, and here Sorensen picks up my clay knife, and this is a knife with a toothed blade on it so that you could sort of slap it into the model and pull it along and it would draw a true straight a clean line. Well, he picks up my clay knife, which I'd left on the stool there, and he starts drawing lines on the front fender because they were trying to figure out how the hell they could make this thing. It was a rather deep drawn design. And I'm in back of them muttering that Sorensen's ruining my model. But they, I think so. And he was the one that's given credit for being able to cast the V8 block in one piece. So he evidently knew a few things about how to make things. As far as casting goes, they at least had to cast the dies to make this fender. So what happened was that it was decided to make it in three pieces. There was a horizontal feature line, a little groove that ran from the back of the fender up to the center of the headlight. And then there was a vertical cut line right over the center line of the wheel in the side view. So you had a top piece and a front piece and a back piece and made in three parts for 41. And then they subsequently cooked up a way of making a special blank and welding the, folding the blank around and welding it where it would be underneath the headlight. And then they would form that in one piece for the 42 model. But that was my closest brush to the top echelons of the company at that time.
Do you remember what any of them said?
No. Uh-uh. No, I don't. I didn't think that snooping close enough to over here was the thing for me to do. And then one of the other characters that visited the design department that I recall very distinctly was Harry Ferguson. I forget what year this was, but we were working on our clay models when there was a Ford tractor set up in the studio, and it was blocked up so that the front grill and the sort of the top tank of this tractor could be modeled in clay. And old Harry himself comes in and hangs up his suit coat, and he was wearing English tweeds. It was a heavy tweed type coat, suit he had, and he hung up his coat, rolled up his sleeves, and he was doing the clay work himself on his front end. And the thing I recall about him was he had the most beautiful pair of all leather suspenders that I've ever seen in my life. Now, I hadn't been exposed to English suspenders or any other item of English clothing at that time. And I was kind of used to the Tom McCann type cheap elastic or whatever, and these things were really glorious leather gaiters that held up his trousers. So Harry did spend a few days in there working on the tractor front end, and I recall Henry number one coming in to look at it a couple times with him. What they argued about later on, I never did find out. Yeah. Real claims to fame that I have in the regard to my early time in the design department is the creation of the first Continental. And Gregory got this request from Edsel, who had set up and was responsible for the design department. And Gregory asked me to create the model in tent size and carry along a little tent size drawing at the same time. And what he did was to move some of these large blackboards. They were blackboards that were big enough to take a full side view of a car and maybe a half section on either end. And they were on rollers, so they could be moved around for show purposes. And we got a couple of those and constructed a temporary partition around Gregory's desk area in the corner of the department. And I had two tables there, tent size modeling tables, and one of them I made this tent size model. And on the other one I carried along at the same time a drawing of the concept. And the idea was to create a unique car for Edsel, which had the same flavor as the European sports cars that he'd seen when traveling in Europe. And these were long hood cars with spare tires mounted on the back. And so, yes?
Do you know what type of model
that caught his eye? No, I don't. I would think that there's more than one, because that was sort of a regular arrangement. If you remember the early MGBs, even though they're small cars, they were set up that way, and the old Lagondas and some of the others were all long hood cars, and I think they actually had, a lot of them had two spares in tandem on the back end, because tire reliability wasn't real great. And anyway, the idea was to take a current Lincoln Zephyr, as much of it as you could, and stretch out the front end, stretch out the hood to create the length there, and then create a special boxy back end with the exposed spare tire. So as I remember, we added 10 inches in the length of the hood and the fender of a standard Zephyr. We used the production Zephyr grill and the front part of the fenders and hood, and put this added length in there. And then designed and styled a convertible type top and boxy back end to complete the design. And I can recall that Edsel used to come in a couple of times a week and look at the progress of this. And when he would come in, especially if Gregory wasn't there at the time, why, I'd say, good morning, Mr. Ford, and scuttle around and find Gregory wherever he was and bring him in. And the thing that impressed me about Edsel was what a quiet, unassuming gentleman he was. He wasn't a loud bull of the woods variety, and he was always just as neatly tailored as you could imagine. I think that his shoes were the first English handmade hand bench shoes that I ever saw, and his pants cuffs were tailored at exactly the right height, and he would always speak to you. And of course, when he and Gregory were conferring, I would sidle up as close as I could without breathing on their necks, and try and get the comments firsthand rather than relying on some interpretation from Bob Gregory later on. And so the model was accepted. It didn't show a heck of a lot of detail, but Edsel was evidently pleased with what he saw and thought it would reflect his desires. So the people at the old Warren Avenue plant, Lincoln plant, were put to work to build one of these things. And I've dug up a couple of photographs of that particular car taken behind the old Warren Avenue plant. And as I recall, the car was shipped down to Palm Beach, where Mr. Ford used to spend his vacation. And he drove it around there, and his friends commented and remarked about it so favorably that he decided to put the thing into production. So it became the Continental. And looking at that little old tent size model in the photographs today, the workmanship sure looks crummy compared to what the boys do today, but at least it got the job done. And then I think it was Martin Gitko had come into the department sometime along there, and he did the hardtop version all on the board. I don't think we ever made a model of the hardtop, but Martin was a kind of a guy. He came from a coach builder, and I don't remember whether it was Braun or LeBaron, one of those outfits that Lincoln dealt with, and he could do a body design from the ground up, all the structural members, the surface development, the glass mechanisms, you name it, he could do the whole bit. And I used to watch him doing his drawing of the hardtop, which was again shipped over to the Warren Avenue plant, I believe, for them to make the first prototype. And when Martin first came in the department, there was an instant bolt of electricity between Martin and old Dick Benike. Head clay modeler, right. A German, Das Kraut.
And Martin Rigitko was to be the layout.
Yeah, now Martin, I don't know what nationality he was, whether it was Hungarian or German or whatever.
Czech?
Could be. Czechoslovakian, perhaps. But there was a little spark of competition or whatever, and I could tell the way Dick grumbled that he was not overly impressed. Well, when Rigitko first came in, he had an armful of plastic curves under his arm, and both Dick and I kind of chuckled a little bit because these curves were pretty flat along the long edge, and they'd make a real sharp turn and then come down pretty flat for the other part of the hook. And they were obviously curves designed to do the type of body sections that Rigitko was used to at his former custom body place. And here Ford had pioneered the rounded shapes, which were exemplified probably best by the 39 Mercury, where the roof was rounded and there was a lot of slope to the glass line and a lot of tumble home to the body side.
Had this been Gregory's innovations, do you think?
I guess you'd have to give Gregory some of the credit. I don't know.
Ford, that's important.
Yes, and I don't know how much creative effort was Benike's himself. You see, the way things went, a lot of times Gregory or nobody else really drew the complete definition of what the shape was supposed to be. In fact, I can remember on the Zephyr, as it was first built, it had an exposed running board. And one of the slicked up, modernized features that we came up with was the concealed running board. The door sheet metal was extended out so that it hid that ugly black rubber thing until you opened the door, and then there it was. And I worked out the type of cut line that you had to have at the front edge of the front door in order to open the door without gouging into the sheet metal. I worked that out on the clay myself just by visualizing the hinge line and how it would swing. So when you think of the 39 Mercury, I don't know whether Dick Benike contributed to the shape or whether it was Gregory or some of the other fellows. It could have been a total team effort as far as I know. But I give Brigitko a lot of credit because he took a look around and saw the sort of shapes that we had evolved and what the direction of so-called modern design was. And first thing you know, he had a vise clamp to his big drawing table. These are horizontal flat tables. And at lunchtime, he proceeded to file on his damn curves until he had a whole family of new, more rounded curves that would suit the work we were doing. So Rikitko had a lot of talent. And as I say, he did that whole damn hardtop continental thing on paper, as far as I know. And I used to be amazed at how he could cut sections through the various framing members, roof rails and door sills and pillars, and indicate to the craftsman how this piece of wood was supposed to be beveled and shaped to provide the structure. So Martin was a pretty good guy. Oh yeah. And a very nice personality. He used to have a sort of a nervous head. He had a limp. I don't remember whether one leg was, he had a problem with one leg or something, but he walked with a limp in one leg. Couldn't tell you whether it's right or left now. And he used to have a way when he talked to you, he'd take the frame of his glasses in his hands and lift it up and down. Yuchin, he would say, if you do it this way, you know. And Dick Benike was interesting to talk to because when he would tell about the old days in Germany, he also used to subscribe to this German language newspaper that was published in Detroit. And I don't remember the title of it, but it was something or other Zeitung, and the headline was in this German script, and there was a red circle, as I recall, with a black swastika right smack in the center. And this one day, he's reading to us about the German people's car. Well, this is the Volkswagen. And he told about how the scheme was that you got a coupon book, and every time you had a little money to spare, well, you go down and buy a stamp and paste it in that book, and when the book was filled, you could turn it in and get your Volkswagen. Well, of course, Hitler and World War II and a few other things sort of got in the way of that. I don't know of any German that ever claimed a Volkswagen with his coupon book or ever got one filled. But it was interesting to have Dick read about that because we used to follow the design trends in the different automobile magazines. And I remember one was, I think, Automobile from England. And a lot of the modern shapes were derived to some extent from the Grand Prix racing cars of that era, Auto Union, Mercedes-Benz, and these other companies were producing some very fast cars that were streamlined, if you will, and brought low to the ground for minimum wind resistance and road hugging ability and so forth. And it was the low grills, the low grills that were sort of drawn on the front shapes of some of these racing cars that inspired the facelift for the 38 Zephyr. And the 38 Zephyr facelift was really the one car that ensured the future of that design department. And when I, Emmett and I first came over, that had already been done, and the, I can't remember whether the model was there or whether the actual prototype grill was there, but that low flowing built into the surface type grill, which was a, we would call it a facelift today of the 37 Zephyr, was really Oh, and the hood had a boat prow effect with a narrow section that came down through the center. That was pretty damned advanced and pretty slick for its point in time. So I had understood that that was the thing that really ensured the success of the design department and allowed them to hire a few more people and bring in some coolies like ourselves from the trade school to help out.
Now, the original Zephyr was done by Tom Jarda, right?
John Jarda of Briggs, yes.
Briggs,
yeah.
And derived from his concept car for the World's Fair.
I think so, yes. That was quite a unique form at that time, quite a unique car.
Incidentally, coincidentally, some people have indicated that the design of that original prototype looks so much like the 1937-38 Volkswagen that they accused Porsche of stealing it.
Well, Dr. Porsche did a great thing when he came up with that car. As an automobile, it's not it never has been a performer by U.S. standards for good noise, vibration, and harshness, but it sure as hell was a reliable design. I know guys that have owned them, and they used to complain about having to grind the valves, the engine being air-cooled and cooled uniformly, and so on. But served very well for a lot of people for transportation. And I know when I was in military later on, I went to Europe and we were briefing the German military on the Shillelagh weapon system that Ford was developing. And so we visited the German tank command group, armored group, and one of our host officers that drove us around for a while had a VW of his own. And I asked him one time if you could have, if money was no object and you could have any German automobile that you could, what would you like to have? Well, his answer was, I'd like to have a Porsche. And the Porsche he was talking about was the one that was currently used by the German police on the Autobahn because it was the fastest damn car around and they could catch anything. And they had to do a lot of catching on the Autobahn because there was really no speed limit at all. So the Porsche designs were certainly respected in Europe. Well, we had another fellow that came in who was a younger guy like ourselves named Bob Thomas. And his name was Robert McGuffey Thomas. He'd gotten a job at Ford because Henry was well acquainted with the McGuffey readers and there was some connection there or sympathy. So Bob got a job and he was helping the fine artist that worked up in the top floor of the lab as the artist for Henry, number one. And what was his name? Anyway. He finally told Bob, he says, geez, you're just never going to make a fine artist. Why don't you get yourself someplace else in the company and I think you'd be better off. And Bob told me this story himself.
He was working for Irving Bacon?
Yes, Bacon is the guy's name.
Right. He was sort of a court painter.
Yes, he was. And I remember that Bob told about how for that Edison 50-year celebration or whatever it was, a big deal that was held at Greenfield Village there. They had this fantastically large banquet hall all set up, and there were all sorts of dignitaries, including President Hoover at that time. And nobody took a picture of the darn thing. And so when Mr. Ford wanted a record of it, they had to go back to the seating arrangement and get individual portraits or photographs of all the people that they knew where they were sitting and so forth. And so Mr. Bacon created this thing out of thin air and all this seating plan and these individual photographs. And this was one thing that Bob was helping him with, I think, to begin with.
We still have it. It still extends.
Is it?
Occasionally we exhibit it. Yes.
Well, the history on those things gets pretty funny. Oh, one other thing that I don't know is documented or not, but in the middle of this design department, at the corner of the engineering lab, it used to be an area where Henry Ford had taught square dancing. And that the whole floor of this engineering lab was a herringbone teak wood affair that was just beautiful. There was always somebody polishing that thing from one end to the other. But anyway, when I got in that design department, one of the things that was still there, and I think it was a holdover from the square dancing days, was this damn stuffed black crow hanging by a wire from the ceiling. Now, if anything belonged to Henry Ford, you didn't monkey with that until he told you to. So that old black crow hung up there for the longest darn time in the middle of the design department. And let's see, what else?
Was,
not that I can recall. No. So it's probably been in the incinerator for quite a while. No? The other thing that we used to do was to make our own tools. Since Jimmy Lynch had his little shop there, which would make sample instruments for instrument panel models and things of that kind. Yes. And Jimmy Lynch had, I think he had charge of the propeller shop at the Ford aircraft operations on the other side of the village road there. And Mr. Ford sort of kiboshed the aircraft operation after his favorite test pilot had died. And
Harry Brooks.
Yeah,
and
Brooks. Yeah.
And
I think it was the Brooks thing that did
it.
But some of those fellas found, well, I don't know whether Al Esper was in the aviation part or not. Al Esper was in charge of our testing, automotive testing for a long time. But anyway, Jimmy Lynch used to have a propeller shop, I believe. So at noon, while we were at our lunch hour, we could go in there and get some spring wire and bend them up and grind them and put handles on them and make our own modeling tools, all patterned after the ones that Dick Benike had. And oh, another fellow that came in a little later, I don't know, maybe 1940 or thereabouts, was Bruno Colt.
Yes.
And Bruno was, again, a very soft-spoken, gentlemanly, timid type of guy, but very good at small-scale modeling in wax for ornamentation and things like that. He was outstanding. So Bruno was one of the guys. But anyway, we would, us younger fellows would look at the tools that the old-timers had, and we'd borrow them and go in and use that as a model to make our own, because most of the time the tools either weren't available or you couldn't afford them at the art supply stores. And we used to make our own French curves, too. There was a supply of plastic there, and we could jigsaw them out and file them in our spare time. You really needed, if you're going to do any surface work, you needed a family of curves, which could be 20 or 30 curves. One thing that I don't remember whether I stressed before was on a full-size model, you get an educated pair of hands after you work with it for a while. And you can feel on a roof panel, for example, which is fairly, on the top, it's fairly flat. It's a gradual curve. We used to have curves there with numbers on them, and I think the number one was only an eighth of an inch height of arc and something like 60 inches width, so it was a pretty flat curve. Anyway, the roof curves were very flat, and after you had worked on a model for a while and learned to scrape clay evenly and to check it for smoothness, you could run your hand over and feel a little depression. And when you actually took a flexible straight edge and laid it in that area, why, you could just barely see light at that spot that felt low. And this is actually less than a thickness of paper. And so the sensitivity is there. And then when you painted that thing, of course, and you had highlights running across it, you could see that there was a little depression. So the degree of smoothness and the fairing of one area into another gradually was what you learned as a clay modeler and what today is exemplified on all of the automotive bodies in the industry is that beautiful surface. And today, of course, they're all trued and calculated with computer, which really the aircraft industry initiated.
Did they?
Yeah. I remember saving articles from magazines where the aircraft companies on the West Coast were the first ones to define mathematically the different sections and the transitions between them as conic functions, mathematical functions. And of course, once you can put something in an equation form, a mathematical form, computerizing it is duck soup. Well, the other sidelight to working in the design department there was there were no girls on the first floor at all, except a couple of secretaries to the higher level guys that were in the front of the building in Walnut Row, and a telephone operator, as I remember. So if you wanted to see a girl, they were upstairs in a secretarial pool. And my wife worked up there at that time. And your chance to see the girls was only during lunchtime if you went down to the cafeteria at the other end of the building. And you'd either see them going, coming, or eating lunch while you were there. And they were not allowed by this old witch that ran the secretarial pool to smile or talk to anybody. They were...
Much less friendly.
Yeah. So any social activity was strictly after hours. And the other thing, of course, at that point in time was that there were absolutely no smoking anyplace, and no candy machines, no coffee machines. And if you wanted to steal a smoke, you went downstairs in the laboratory and were very careful about what you were doing, because getting caught smoking was a cause for instant dismissal. And one technique I learned, because I used to go to the John and try and do a little homework on my calculus or whatever at the same time. And one technique that one of the guys taught me to avoid falling to sleep in the John was to stick your index finger out, palm down, and hang your keys over your finger. And if you happen to get a little sleepy and doze off, your finger would relax, the keys would fall on the floor and make a racket and wake you up again, you see. So, yeah, the old Ford people developed a lot of subterfuges to get around the tyrannical management that they had at that
time.
Did
Bennett ever impinge on the design department?
I don't ever remember seeing him, no. Now, I can... the elder Mr. Ford, I've seen him while he came in to talk to Ferguson that time. But he studiously avoided the thing, and I don't believe he really understood or sympathized with what was going on. And I remember when I was working on the front end of this one Lincoln model, the one with the boxy front end, and we had this Cadillac 60 Special alongside of it, Mr. Ford walked in the door at that end of the department partitions there. He walked in maybe 10 or 15 feet and stood there just sort of looking around and shook his head a couple times and walked back out. So I sort of assumed that that wasn't his thing. And it was Edsel's baby, and styling wasn't Mr. Ford's forte. But I remember when the war came along, any of us that could do drafting or engineering work were put on to war projects that Ford had. We started on the B-24 work, and some of those crummy prototype drawings that we had from Consolidated Baltic were just amazing at their crudity. But anyway,
you had to accept those in the early days.
Oh yeah, and we were making Ford drawings from that, and I recall making the drawings of their engine mounts, which were tubular, welded tubular structures, making drawings of their engine mounts and making details of all the individual tubes and how they had to be cut to weld them together and make a mount. And anyway, all of us that could do any of that sort of thing were put on that activity, and the styling work just just died, some of the artists were making cutaway drawings of the B-24 and illustrations for technical manuals and things like that. But the styling activity just sort of died. And then the guy that was directing us on this type of work, there was war projects that we were cooperating with Bell Telephone Lab. We had some independent Ford projects. And the guy that was the head of this, sort of chief engineer, was old Joe Galam.
Oh, yeah.
And Joe used to come around to your board and look at what you'd done and offer suggestions, and he'd say, "Vi make a disve," and pull out a little stub pencil about an inch and a half long and proceed to mark what he was thinking about on your drawing and put the pencil back in his vest pocket. And as I recall, he had whitish gray hair and a black mustache and was sort of an old country gentleman.
Hungarian.
Yeah, I believe. And he was the guy that I talked to when I left the company in 1942, because I had graduated from college and I met some guys in class there that were working at Briggs on these advanced engine designs. And they had an opening, and this one fellow introduced me to the boss and evidently gave him a line of the fact that I was a good guy or something. And I believe, memory's getting fuzzy on this, but I believe the offer was $300 a month salary. And that was pretty damn attractive. I know I wasn't making it. So I remember talking to Mr. Galam, told him I'd like to stay at Ford, and if he could